So how many of you all were smiling big behind your masks while Becca was singing, right? And I'm sure some of the folks at home were smiling as well. Oh, so beautiful. Thank you, Becca. Yes. So, boy, it was interesting to know what to talk about today because the world has been kind of kooky, right? Am I alone in that? The world has been quite strange lately. You know, the name of the talk title is What Would the Infinite Do? And of course, some of you may be familiar, if you were raised Christian, you know, we were all taught to say, what would Jesus do? Notice I said that with a slight Southern accent because that's where I did most of my Christianity, was in North Carolina. What would Jesus do? Now that I'm doing this, I kind of have to say, what would a Judeo-Christian, Hindu, Sufi religious scientist do? That doesn't work really well. So I say, what would the infinite do? What would the infinite do? And I looked at a lot of sources to try and figure out what the infinite would do. All day yesterday, I read all kinds of sources. I read Joel Goldsmith, and I read this book on mindfulness and racism that was wonderful by Rhonda McGee. And I looked at videos, and I just studied all day. And then I opened up Facebook, and somebody on the Facebook page said, the infinite wouldn't do anything, it would just be. I'm like, great. There goes my whole talk. But then I was like, ooh, great, there goes my whole talk. See ya. But, you know, yes, the infinite would just be, but we are the embodiment of the infinite. So while we're here, yes, we can just be, and we absolutely have to develop the consciousness, but we also have to do something too. You know, and you may be saying to yourself, do something about what? Perhaps that's obvious. That we're in the midst of a pandemic still, that there's an economic collapse, semi-collapse going on for many people, economic challenges, that there is all of this racial unrest going on. And last week there were fires, you know? It's kind of like a trifecta of things that are going on. And so what does the infinite do about all of that? You know, the truth is that the infinite is all of that, that this is all manifestations of the infinite, but how do we navigate that in a way that makes sense? How do we act as if we remember who we are? The song that we usually sing when we're allowed to sing, I am remembering who I am. How do we act as if we remember who we are? It's hard because we are driven by survival. You know, that our human brains are wired for survival, that, and part of survival often involves tribalism, you know, in terms of the racial issues that are going on, survival involves tribalism. I see that in the animal kingdom, I see it in my dogs. My dogs really like other dogs that look like them. They like other pointers or other vishlas. They struggle with little dogs. They're biased against little dogs. And it's not to say that we should be more like my dogs, God forbid. but we still have that biological tendency to separate and to be biased and to be prejudiced. And we need to find a way, an infinite way, to overcome that. That to me seems like the whole teaching of Christianity, of mystical Christianity, is to notice where we are excluding people or marginalizing people and then bringing them into the center where we all belong. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field, I will meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. We are constantly heading towards Rumi's field. And not everybody is getting that. You know, and some of the stuff that I've been watching the news and like I said, reading a lot of sources and talking with people, talking with clergy, and it seems like the news isn't getting the thing of Rumi's field, of coming together in a greater sense of wholeness, and it seems like even some of the churches aren't necessarily getting that. People want to polarize, people want to be mad, people want to push back, and that's not a bad thing, but it often feels to me like something is missing. Something is missing from that scenario. I had to write a quote for the paper, and I wrote the the usual stuff that the other ministers were writing, and like racism is bad and we need to do what we can do to ameliorate the effects of this. And I threw in one little thing about the third force, about knowing that there is a power and a presence that is greater than any of this. You know, Gandhi said it. Gandhi said it. Probably didn't, I don't know if he even heard of the third force. Gandhi said it. He said that no matter what's going on, love always wins. Love is always stronger. They chose not to publish that part. And maybe they said it in a different way, but and I'm not offended by it. I wasn't attached to what I wrote, but that's the point that I'm making. It seems that we have a tendency to miss something. We have a tendency to miss the power of reconciliation that is inherent, that is actually engaged in this conflict that is going on. This conflict that happened when a white man knelt on a black man's neck. And I'm not saying that was right, but I'm saying that it was a tremendous wake-up call for all of us to find greater peace and greater healing and greater reconciliation. And it's not about them healing, it's about all of us healing. And the only people we can really work on is ourselves. I was chatting with our board president, my friend Lonnie, the other day, and she was talking about when she was a little kid living up in Northern California. They had one of those above ground pools, you know, remember those things? And she said that the kids in the neighborhood would gather together and they would all run in a circle like this. And they'd get a current going that was going all in the same circle. You know, does that remind you of anything, right? The human race, we're all in this current. We're all swept up in this wave. And then they would stop and observe the current. And the current's still going, but eventually it calms down. So maybe today, maybe this is an invitation to just pause and take a look. One of the ways that I have taught the third force, and for those of you who are not familiar with some of the stuff that we teach here that is somewhat unique to some of the other science of mind teachings, the third force, it's actually very similar to what Ernest Holmes says and what I just said about Gandhi. Beyond opposites, there is a power and a presence that holds everything, and we press on that wholeness. We open up to receive that wholeness and to know that wholeness in all things. There is nothing to be healed, only wholeness to be revealed, and that is our spiritual work. Our spiritual work of revealing wholeness. So when I teach the third force, I teach a four-letter acronym, P-R-A-Y. P is for pause. Pause like Lonnie and her friends did in the whirlpool and just see that the whirlpool is spinning. R is for respect. Respect means to respeculate, to see again, see it a different way. A means to appreciate. Appreciate that this is happening for our collective awakening. And Y, yearn for wholeness. Yearn for solution. Yearn for equity. Yearn for justice for all beings. So that's part of what I think the infinite would do. I think that the infinite lies stretched in smiling repose and is waiting for us to wake up so that it can express and experience more of itself in any given moment. How to be more specific about that? You know, a while ago I was talking about how we're all geared for survival. Our brains are geared towards survival, and that we have this adrenaline reaction to things that are different. And we often react out of fear, which is born of ignorance of our true nature, and that often manifests as actions against humanity or actions against people that are different than us. I have a story about survival that is a very different kind of story. This story was told to me a long time ago by our friend, our brother Brock Travis. And I may not have all of the details right. I might embellish it, but you'll get the gist of it. When Brock was quite a bit younger, he was taking a course somewhere, and it was a small group seminar, a discussion. And it was a somewhat diverse group. Brock was there. There were two feminists, two very adamant feminists that were there, and others. And they were all a little bit different than each other. But the one who stood out the most was someone that I might lovingly call a redneck. I don't know what to say anymore. I don't know what you're allowed to say anymore, but I'm hoping that the term redneck is acceptable for all of you. And he was very opinionated about everything. And he put down women, and he put down other races, and he put down people that were different. Now the feminists, they didn't react. But one of them lay in wait for him. And when he finally said something really bad in front of the whole group, she eviscerated him. She tore him up. She humiliated him. She shamed him. And he was left speechless and stunned. Now, as the facilitator, I would be nervous about that. I'd be like, okay, what do we do next? I guess maybe we change the subject, maybe we go on. What do we do with this energy? But this young Hispanic man who had no business being this wise, see, that's my ageism coming out. How can young people be wiser than me? This young Hispanic man, in the silence that followed this evisceration, said, "Our brother has fallen, and we cannot go on." And that led to a discussion that brought at least a certain amount of peace and healing and reconciliation to the room. Where all of the talk about the unrest in the Black community, people that are critical of it, people that are supportive of it, people that are struggling with it. When I think of the video of George Floyd and the cop, that phrase goes through my head relentlessly. Our brother has fallen, and we can't go on. Something has got to change. Now, one thing that I think that we can change that is powerful and mighty, you know, I spoke about this idea that we all want to survive. What if we have the wrong definition of survival? What if survival is not, I'm going to take something from you so I have more so that I can survive? What if survival is about making sure that everybody survives? That everybody is enlisted in this wholeness that we call life? What if survival is actually the new compassion? Wait, no, compassion is the new survival. What would that be like? What would that be like to put compassion and understanding that when our brothers and sisters fall, we must lift them up? Whatever that takes from us, what would that be like? I invite you to explore that in the coming weeks as you listen to the news or as you read things or as you have conversations. Let us play in the field of the infinite and redefine survival. That it's not only survival, but it is the thriving, the blessing of all beings. Another thing that I've observed, you know, I've been reading this Joel Goldsmith book, the one that he was reading was from, and it's called The Government of Eden. And a lot of times people in New Thought will say very cavalierly, there is no evil. That might also be translated to, there is no racism. That might be offensive to some at this point in time. It's a bit like denying that the Holocaust happened. Now, when you read a little deeper, when you read Joel Goldsmith or when you read Ernest Holmes a little bit deeper, they say, of course, to the ego, there is evil and there is racism. But then if you go deeper still, you see that there is also an unreality to evil and to racism. I'll explain that. Oddly, I don't know how this happened to me, But in January of 2018, I went to India. I got off the plane. I went to the place where we were staying, had jet lag. I woke up, I staggered out onto the lawn, and I met Meghna, the woman who makes these heart pins, the woman who runs the program that makes these Indian heart pins, women in the slums who make these pins and offer them as gifts, or people can pay for them and make a donation if they want. And Meghna told me the story of the place where we were staying. It was started by a man named Ishwar Patel, Ishwar Dada, they called him. Dada is like a term of endearment. And when Ishwar Dada was just a child, he was with his aunt, and he picked up a broom and he started sweeping. Now the aunt suddenly became very upset, very offended. She said, "Ishwar, that was touched by an untouchable. Now that you've touched that broom and you're sweeping, you're an untouchable too." And she said, "There is a way out though. What you can do is you can come over here and you can wash your hands with this special water, and then you won't be an untouchable anymore." So that's racism. The untouchables have been around for, there's debates as to when that whole caste system started, but some say as early as 1500 BC. It's been going on forever. But do you see how arbitrary that is? It's a bit like, if you say a certain word in a theater, which clearly I'm still attached to because I can't say it, you have to turn around three times, and you have to spit, and then you have to swear. Beep! And that makes it okay if you say that word, right? It's not a swear word, it's the name of a play. The Scottish play, for those of you who may know what I'm talking about. I'll tell you outside. See how committed I am to not saying that word? So... But it's just like that. It's something that people made up. Somebody made up that this person over here is untouchable and this person over here is not. And if you touch that person's broom, then, oh my gosh, you're untouchable. And then, but there's a cure. Then the cure is washing your hands with this water, and then, whew, thank God, you're not untouchable anymore. So you see how that is? You see how we are? We're crazy. We're crazy. In this book that I'm reading, I'm going to tell you the name of it, The Inner Work of Racial Justice by Rhonda McGee, she talks about how in 1984, she grew up in a poor town, in a poor section of a poor town. She's black. And she grew up, and suddenly in the summer of 1984, she was a senior in high school, and her life was about to start. She was getting ready to go to college, and she was about to be elected Teenager of the Year in her town, and she was in love. She was in love with a wonderful young man, a wonderful young man. And then, one day, her boyfriend called her up, and he said, "I don't have a place to live anymore." His parents had kicked him out of the house because they couldn't handle him dating a black woman. Rhonda asked us to check and see if we assumed that she was dating a black guy, but she was dating a white guy, and the parents couldn't handle it. And she said that it hurt her. She continued to date him, but it still hurt her that his parents would think that she was so bad that they had to throw their son out of the house. And that affected her whole life, of thinking, wow, because I am this color, there are people who are gonna be willing to sacrifice something so important to them just to get rid of me. And she wrote in her book, I'll read this quote, again, it's about making up racism. She says, "Race is a matter of social imagination and construction. It's of perceptions shaped by a given context. For example, someone who might be considered too white in the Caribbean might be considered unequivocally too black in the US. So we're making up stuff all the time. And I think that the infinite would know, as I often say, that our vision of reality is not the whole picture of reality. What the infinite would ask us to do is to look at our assumptions, to look at what we're listening to look at what we're believing, and to say to ourselves, is this really true? And if it excludes somebody, if it's not about wholeness, then it's not true. The infinite invites us to look within and redefine reality always. in the framework of compassion. The infinite would say, perhaps, that our certainty is getting in our way, and that uncertainty, the willingness to be in the mystery, is the new certainty. It is our salvation. And it's not comfortable, but that doesn't matter. And the other thing I want to point out is that this is an inside job. This is an individual job. This has to be done by everybody individually in their own and unique and wonderful way. You know, right now, if you've been reading a lot of literature on the internet and whatnot about the racist challenges that are going on in this country, it's become a thing for white people to say, "I am a racist." And it's funny, I have been reluctant to say that, even though to a certain extent, it depends on how you define the word racist. And I know that I would get in trouble with certain people because I won't say I'm a racist. People would be mad at me. They would think that I'm part of the problem. And I already acknowledge I am part of the problem. But they would think that saying that one phrase makes me part of the problem, a big problem. And the reason I'm reluctant to say it is twofold. I mentioned that I lived in North Carolina for a while. And I lived in North Carolina in the late 70s and in the early 80s. And that was not that long after things started to become integrated. So there was a big racial divide in North Carolina. And I also worked in a hospital where we had to treat everybody. So if somebody injured themselves burning a cross in somebody's front yard, they would come to the hospital and we would have to treat them. And so to me, that's what a racist is. Somebody who is actively, deliberately hating on black people or people of any race. And yet, I know, I understand the subtleties. I understand the subtleties that racism is systemic and that we're all subtly doing things that get in the way. But I also am very particular about the word I am, because I am is a sacred phrase. I am remembering who I am. Do I really want to affirm that I am a racist? What I am willing to do is affirm that, wow, I have something to learn here. I don't know everything. I don't know anything about what it's like to be a minority in this country. I know a little bit about what it's like to be a woman, and even that is jaded because I was raised in a household with like the bossiest women in the world, so so I know a lot about powerful women. But you know, I don't know what it's like to be black, so I am willing to transcend the limitations of my experience and be part of the solution, to be part of the solution, to look at ways that I may have actively participated in perpetuating racism, ways that I've actively perpetuated holding people down, and find new and creative and constructive ways to bring about, again, that greater sense of wholeness and that greater sense of love. It's wonderful to hold these high intentions and to talk about it and to trust it and to know it and to know that it's real. But it's not really real until we do something about it, is it? That's why, you know, one of the things that I love about the Christian message is that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The Word of goodness, the Word of wholeness needs to become flesh and part of our being and part of our experience. What does that look like? Certainly, I can tell you my experience and the experiences of people that I've spoken with. It looks like educating ourselves, looking at news media or YouTubes or other films of things that are going to stretch us, things that may not be comfortable. Lonnie sent me some incredible videos called Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. So wonderful, so wise. And what I loved about it, I get sent a lot of videos, and I don't always like all of them. There's too much of an edge to some of them. There's too much of trying to drive out racism with racism. This guy was so kind and so loving and so geared towards wholeness. It's Emmanuel Acho, A-C-H-O. It's like a chew, but take out the last O, okay? That's how I remember it. I'm not gonna sneeze. that's frowned upon these days, among other things. But just so beautifully stated are some of the questions that a lot of people have asked me that I don't have good answers for. So educating ourselves, reading more, watching more YouTubes, watching things that are different, that are going to stretch us into a new way of seeing. That's so important, because we don't know everything. We have one tiny little fragment of reality, and we're calling it the truth, and it's just not real. It's just not real. Moving ourselves into a greater acceptance of having a broader horizon and a broader view. Another thing we can do is have conversations. Now, by conversations, I mean that we talk, but we also get to listen, right? I'm still working on that one. I would much rather just blurt out my opinions and not care so much about what the other person has to say. God, that's embarrassing. Why don't I just admit that in church? But talking and listening, perhaps with the goal towards greater understanding. Greater wholeness. And greater compassion, even for people that seem like they are against you, against us, against others, against what you believe. So there's that. There's respecting. And then there's the thing that I always say. Acts of kindness. Again, you know, and I'm obsessed with acts of kindness, because, you know, it wouldn't be if it was just an aimless pursuit, but it is a high-level form of meditation that is often overlooked. You know, I've presented this thought of that the world could be changed by acts of kindness, by having a kindness department in our denomination. Not many people want to hear that, for whatever reason. They think that kindness is wimpy, but it is so powerful. It is so incredibly powerful. 2 weeks ago, when I spoke about the death of George Floyd, and Shelley started a website about acts of kindness, and we're supposed to do 9 acts of kindness, and several of us have been doing it. It didn't really take off, but I also understand that sometimes people are reluctant to write down acts of kindness because it feels a little braggy. It feels a little braggy sometimes. But what I've observed in participating in this website is that someone's act of kindness inspires my act of kindness. And we also talk about our reluctance. You know, you have this idea about an act of kindness, and then you think, oh, I don't know about that. That makes me too vulnerable. But then we encourage each other to do it anyway. And what I have found, you know, had so many miraculous encounters through this, one of which was with my neighbors, who are a different race than I am. I'm actually a minority in the town where I live, but it's being a white minority is very different than being a black or a Hispanic minority. But anyway, I'm a minority. I went over there one time, and I really felt like my white privilege was getting in the way of a relationship. I could feel their fear of me. And all I did was go over and ask if I could give them something. Granted, they had a super loud party the night before, and they might have been afraid I was going to complain, but I didn't. But anyway, through giving them a gift, and then later on, during this act of kindness thing, bringing them food, I made the whitest Mexican food ever. Okay, and I gave it to them because I didn't know any better until I tasted it. But anyway, you know, then they brought us avocados, and then we brought them a zucchini, and I'm starting to get to know their kids. And so, isn't it possible that that type of energy can really be powerful and can really change the world? Because it lifted me up. It lifted me up. It lifted me so much that I'm sharing it here in church. It inspired me to look for other opportunities to serve. And I think that the same thing is available for all of us. I know it's available for all of us. It doesn't take a lot to do a small act of kindness for someone. Right? How's it going over there? Good job. Okay. For those of you watching, we have a small child who is doing an excellent job. He really is. Becca's little boy. He's great. Yay. It's really nice to have a child in the house too, by the way. So all of this stuff, you know, I think sometimes what it comes right down to as well is just, I don't know if we're allowed to say this in religious science. I don't know if we're allowed to say this in psychology. But I just want to be better. I want to do better. I want to be kinder. I want to be more loving. I want to be kinder to my church. I want to be kinder to my husband. I want to be kinder to our board president, to the sound man, to Chris. I want to be kinder to everybody. And I want to be kinder to people that believe that they're disenfranchised, to people that believe that they are being cast out, to people that are feeling the pain of being separate, that are feeling the pain of being pushed down for years. And I don't know the answer. I know that there are valid opinions on both sides of any question, but I just want to be better. I just want to ask them, is there something that I can do? Is there something that I can do to help? And then do it. I'm going to close with a quote from Shantideva, which I think speaks to what I'm talking about. May I be a guard for those who need protection, a guide for those on the path, a boat, a raft, a bridge for those who wish to cross the flood. May I be a lamp in the darkness. May I be a resting place for the weary, a healing medicine for all who are sick, a vase of plenty, a tree of miracles, and for the boundless multitudes of living beings, may I bring sustenance and awakening, enduring like the earth and sky, until all beings are freed from sorrow and all are awakened. That's what I want. I hope you want it too. Let us pray. Together we turn within and trust to know that there truly is one power, one presence, one life that is God's life. This is the life of the infinite. This is the life of love, and it circulates in us right here and right now because it is who we are. It arises within us and fills us. It always has. We're just aware of it now. And so from this place of the infinite, we embrace all beings. We trust that there is a higher path that is emerging in all of this craziness that is happening in the world. And that we don't know what this path looks like. We don't know who is right, who is wrong. We just trust that something is pulling us forward. Something is pulling us to a greater essence of wholeness and justice and love and kindness. Something greater is moving through us to include all sides in a conversation and to allow that reconciliation of opposites to move us to something beyond what we could have ever imagined for humanity and for life. Yes, we say yes to being better. We say yes to being a light for all beings and lifting up anybody who is suffering. We say yes to kindness. We say yes to respect. We say yes to the infinite, expressing in a multitude of ways uniquely as us. And so I just give thanks for all of this. I give thanks for this power, for this presence, for this love. I give thanks for the transformation that I know is taking place here in this room and here in our virtual community. And I know that these words and this message and the whole energy of this service that is made possible by all of us joining together, I know that this blesses the world, blesses all beings everywhere. And so I bless this path. I bless this beautiful center. I bless all of the beings in it and beyond. I bless all paths to God, churches, synagogues, temples, mosques, ashrams, fundamentalists, atheists, all beings. And with a heart that is so filled with blessedness, I say thank you, Spirit, thank you, God, and I release these words into the divine mystery, and together we say, and so it is.